Yo.
At some point, I would love to sit down and give a talk about the process.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. I think I wrote and had like a bunch of weird things in there that, like, I had the section thing. I realized the link to that wasn't anywhere, so if you guys actually found the link to generate all the sections.
I did that on my
hand. Oh, well. Nothing beats a computer in the end, right?
Yeah, it'll be fine. I was thinking if I could find sit down with it. If you don't mind, just running it, I
said. Yeah. No, totally go. It's pretty resettable. There's not a lot of things. You can make backups of it before you start playing around. All right, awesome. Looks like we're mostly all here. Welcome to 147 lecture, or lab lecture number one. I'm Mike Krieger. A little bit about me. I was a Stanford HCI undergrad and grad student. I majored in symbolic systems. Any SimSys majors out there? There's one in the back. Awesome. And I work at Mevo.com now. We're a startup in Mountain View. Actually, we're getting pretty big to call ourselves a startup. But I do user experience and front engineering there. So I basically get to take all the stuff I learned in 147 and 247 and do it in the real world. It's like my dream job. So that's a little bit about me. And I'd love to hear just in aggregate a little bit about you. How many of you are computer science majors? That's a fair amount of you. How many of you are like humanities majors? Awesome. And how many of you have ever made a website before? Imagine like they make you do that in middle school nowadays or something. Yeah. And how much do you consider yourselves experienced in web application design or development? A fair few. So the challenge with these lab courses, and I'll go into this in a little bit, is sort of keeping it interesting for the people who are experienced, but also have enough meat for the people who haven't seen a lot before. So I'll talk about that in a couple of slides, how to make the most of it. So by the end of the day, what I hope you'll get out of it, know what this lab will and won't teach you. Have checked out this week's materials from SVN, from Subversion, and we'll talk about that more later. And if you want to follow along, we'll be making a really basic iPhone-friendly HTML5 document with a list and a video tag. It's exciting times. Awesome. So just the basics administrative stuff. This is a one-unit class. It's pass-fail, and it's an honor code system. At the end of the quarter, if you decide to take it for credit, you just have to send me an email saying that you, by the honor code, attended at least 8 of the 9 lectures. That's pretty simple. If you're taking 547, Stasis 547, it's the same system, except I don't have a sign-in sheet. I just will take your word for it. It's really quick. What this class isn't it about. What it is about, it's very practical skills. I think Scott will cover more of the theory behind it. Even 147 is pretty practical throughout. But this is basically the nuts and bolts of building your prototype and your web applications. We'll be working with HTML, JavaScript, CSS, and Python on the server side. We might switch it to PHP if there's a strong demand for learning PHP instead. I think Python is nicer and will serve you better in the real world, but that's just me. We'll from the start, we'll have an emphasis on mobile. I think you get your iPod touches right after you form your groups, which I think is weak. Three or so, but before then, we can have, this is like a good Mac to PC ratio here. I think a lot of you will be able to just try stuff out in the iPhone simulator, which you can just get for free, and the rest can just use Safari on Windows or Chrome on Windows for now, and then start throwing your stuff on mobile as soon as you get your iPod touches. And sort of as the bonus features, I was talking to Scott before the quarter, and he's like, well, what are some things that you've picked up since graduating that you think would be really useful for people to learn a little earlier? And two of those are just version control. Like, when you get in your groups, I remember this from almost every project class I did at Stanford, it gets messy really quickly. It's like, who has the latest files? Oh, I'll send you a zip. Okay, here's the zip file. And then it gets really messy. And then next thing you know, like, you turn in the wrong version. And I've seen that happen. So we'll go into that sort of hands-on version control throughout the quarter, and this is what you'll be using to coordinate within your groups. And we'll be learning about Google Analytics, which, who's like ever installed Google Analytics on a website before? It's like just a few of you. It's super useful. I do stats and analytics at Mevo too, and like for a startup, when you don't have like A, the money to pay for the ridiculously priced, more expensive options, and B, the time to roll out your own, this is like the way of just making sure your app is instrumented from the get-go. Of course, the trade-off with this class isn't about is Objective-C and Cocoa, so we won't be learning how to make iPhone native apps. But we found a few groups tried it last year. I don't know how much Scott covered it in lecture, but the ramp-up is pretty steep. Even in 193P, which I took, like the first quarter was offered here, which is the iPhone class, which is a good class to take if you have room in your schedule for it. There's like a significant ramp-up, and it's really nice for making really like fleshed-out, polished apps. But for prototyping, it's just going to get in your way for like 8 of the weeks. And it's going to be like week 10, you're going to be stressing out because you can't get your thing working. And why isn't the UI navigation controller view popping my UI view controller? And like, this is the kind of thing we saw last year. It's like a lot of late nights. So we won't be covering that. And we won't be talking a lot about the cross-platform JavaScript development issues, which is actually what makes JavaScript kind of hard is, 30% of our users at Meebo are still on IE, for example. So we have to support IE6, which is like full of goofy old problems if you've ever worked with the web. So we won't be really covering that. The really nice thing about the iPod Touch that you'll be developing for the iPhone is like, you can assume a lot. People are on the mobile browser and it's WebKit based. And you could probably even make it work on like the pre, and Android also has WebKit based browsers. So I think WebKit, which is what powers the iPhone mobile Safari, is like becoming the standard for mobile development. And with that trade-off, there's a few things you can't do with a web app on an iPhone. I'll use iPhone and iPod Touch interchangeably. Whenever I say iPhone, you can kind of just assume I mean iPod Touch. You can't get the real-time accelerometer. You can just get rotation changes. So if you end up wanting to do something more accelerometer-based, you might have to fake it, basically Wizard of Oz. Just like, oh, well, you know, we'll pretend you're finding the accelerometer. And obviously some device APIs, like popping open an email pane, core data, and the camera. So that's another thing where, like, we might have to get into some, like, well, this isn't exactly how it would work if it was a full app, but, you know, you can imagine here. And that's the whole point of the prototype, is just conveying the ideas as closely as possible. But just so you don't get discouraged and think, wow, there's no good iPhone web apps out there if you can't get access to those things, I want to show you two really quick. This is just the iPhone simulator. If you have Mac OS X, you can just download this from Apple. It's huge, but it's free. It'll let you more quickly develop and prototype your iPhone apps. Even when you're in your groups, that might be, if at least one of you has a Mac, it might be a good way to like do most of your development just with the simulator open, just refreshing the page. And then when you need to actually kind of get to the nuts and bolts of the device, you can start doing that more on the device. If you live in San Francisco, you know that like finding one of the next buses is really difficult. It's like a constant source of stress. This is my friend wrote this web app that this is all HTML and JavaScript and CSS. So it looks a lot like a native app. It has a lot of these, you know, kind of iPhone conventions. And then, you know, it does this nice little Helvetica action here. Things fly in. You hit plus, it slides back, and you can add it to your view. So there's a lot you can do, even with just the HTML and JavaScript. Another one is, like, somebody made a Sudoku app. It's kind of cool. So this load. You know, so you touch this, and it goes, oh, which one do you want? Here. And as you'll see, like, you can respond to touch events and swipe events and a lot of those things. So there's a lot of richness you can have there. I don't know what they can do for the menu. And not shown here, but you can actually have like the whole thing flip in 3D using just CSS, which is pretty awesome.
Is this available for PCs at all?
No. The closest thing you'll get is just downloading WebKit, which is the thing that powers Safari. They have nightly builds, which have a lot of the upcoming features that are already in the iPhone, and then just like resizing your browser. There are some things that won't quite work, like you won't be able to add things to the home screen, for example, but most of the HTML and JavaScript and CSS should work. I don't know who asked that, but yeah.
Where do you get the CSS?
If you go to developer.apple.com, they'll have a link to that. It's just called, it'll come as part of Xcode, which is their full like development environment, and you won't use like 90% of Xcode, but you can use the iPhone simulator.
So if I have an Xcode,
yes, I don't know if they do this anymore. They used to have like Xcode normal and Xcode iPhone. I think right now they're like, well, everybody wants to build iPhone apps. So I think Xcode just comes with the iPhone stuff now. If it doesn't, then search for like iPhone SDK, and it'll come with it might be like a whole other download, but then you'll have that. But yeah, so those are quick examples of what you can build using just HTML, JavaScript, and WebKit. Yeah?
Would it be possible to download that simulator on one of the university computers and computer rooms?
Yeah, you should talk to your RCC about that probably. No? Really? Yeah, so that's a bummer. The nice thing is, as soon as you get your device, it won't be too bad. Like, you can just load it up. You can serve it off your web space and just have it reloading on the device. It's only for the first couple weeks, and there's not like a massive. I don't think there's no programming assignments due in the first couple weeks anyway. So it's mostly like if you want to try out some of these things ahead of time, it should not be a big issue. Hey, Abel.
Hi.
and Maria. Like, should I take this class? These are three candidate strawman personas I built up. So I don't know how representative these are. Hopefully you'll fall into at least one of these or one of these buckets. Since it's a lab class and it's optional, if you think, oh, wow, this, I'll hit the next slide, I think is the list of topics. If it looks like, wow, this is all stuff I've seen before, but I'd really like to know more about like Python or more about iPhone-specific features, feel free to take it just ad hoc and come to those one or two lectures. If you're like, well, like, yeah, I could use another unit, and this all looks pretty interesting, just come on by and just submit the honor code thing at the end of the quarter. Does that make sense? Any questions about that? We'll be working, well, I guess I'll be working, and you can follow along on a quarter project, and It's going to be a 147 portfolio, which actually is kind of nice. Like I remember a lot of my classmates, we had to make a portfolio back when I took it, would like show it in job interviews, and people were like, wow, you do design in college, this is amazing, and they got jobs. So that's one like motivation to do it. But that's what we'll be working on. So just to apply what we learn week to week, we'll just be building this 147 portfolio, and feel free to follow along. Every week you'll just be able to check out the latest code and like adapt it to your own stuff or follow along and see where you get to. Awesome. And here's the quarter at a glance. Today, we're just going to jump in to what's new in HTML5 and what's iPhone specific about HTML or in the stuff that it supports. And then I actually won't read all of these to you, except to point out that like the video prototype, I think, is due the week after that tutorial. And I taught the video prototyping tutorial last year, so that's something I've done before. And they'll just get hands-on, probably use iMovie, and figure out how to get to a video prototype really quickly so it doesn't eat your whole week, which it can. And yeah, any question? And also the other thing to point out is that last week we won't have class, but I'll be here if you have any questions. So at that point, like, there'll be user testing, so I think the incremental value of another class is pretty low. Cool, any questions about the schedule? Cool. There's a Google group that I think Abel is the tech person for, I'm not sure though. I'll just send TAs are the... Cool. So that's the link right there. It's also linked from the 147 homepage. And the TAs will be, I guess, reading that to answer questions. It would be great if you could help each other out as well if there's things you discover. If there are things that keep coming up in the group or things that are really unclear, I'll just address them in lab afterwards.
And Mike, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Screencast?
Yeah. I'm recording it right now, and I'll post it probably off the 147 homepage.
Or we can post it on the group.
Yeah, we should also link it to the group, I think. Yeah, just have it for both. Yeah. And I'll have the slides and my voice and like a little picture of me, too. It'll be exciting. Cool. So what we'll be doing week to week is just checking out the latest version of the file. So what that means, or why we're learning version control, again, it's like a practical real-world skill. It'll help you in your groups to keep you from going crazy. And also, in the last couple of years, a lot of free hosting options have come up for version control. A lot of them require your project to be open source, but it's a 147 project, so that should be probably okay. Can't really. If you think your project is meriting of a closed source approach, you probably have the resources to go out and seek your own solution anyway. But we'll be using Google Code. There's also quite a few other options available online, and it'll be an easy way to get your group going really quickly and just like coordinated on the Subversion stuff. Just to get Subversion, if you're on a Mac, you're done. It comes with the operating system on Windows, and I'll post these slides with the link. You can download it from there. And one really nice plugin is to download Tortoise SVN, which means in Explorer you can right-click a file and like get all the options for that file as regards to your repository. And if you have Linux, you probably already have Subversion, but if you don't, you'll probably figure it out how to get that soon. This is a 5-minute primer to version control. The basic idea in version control, is that especially traditional version control like Subversion, which is I think by far the most popular version control system out there today. You have a central repository which lives somewhere on some server. In our case, it'll live on Google Code. It could live on your machine or some other server. And you're basically running in cycles of committing and checking out and committing. So you check out the latest version. You're like, all right, what's new here? The version control system tries its best to merge its changes with what you might have done locally, fix it up, make changes, and commit it back to the central repository. So over the course of like a week, you might be a really, really simple example. So there's a purple person and a red person. And the first person starts off by writing a file that says, hello world, and then, no, that doesn't sound right. How about hello CS47? So at this point, the system is at revision 2. And the next person, when they check out the code, gets hello to CS247, and maybe they say, it won't be a little cooler if they sub CS147. So that's kind of a really quick intro to it. As you go through the code, you'll see how it works. The week when you set up your groups, we'll go through how you can for your own group, and that'll get you going pretty well. And I think a lot of this we'll just learn as we go head on. There's a lot more complex things you can do with version control. Like if you're off on your own doing some kind of crazy refactor or project, you can branch off and then merge back. We won't be dealing with most of those things unless that comes up as a thing that we're really interested in studying. And to get started, if you want to check out the week-to-week code, that's the URL. Again, if you have a Mac or Linux, or you've already installed Subversion on your Windows PC, you should just be able to run that. And right now, it's a pretty slim repository. I think it has like the week's one demo file that I'll show off later, but not much else. And then as we go week to week, we'll just be able to do a quick command. You'll have the latest code every week, which is nice.
Another couple seconds if anybody's still like typing that in. Cool. And again, these will be online later, so don't worry if you didn't. If you don't have your laptop or something like that. Again, we'll help set up a group repository later in the quarter. So any questions so far? That was mostly administrative stuff and sort of an intro to how we'll be doing things week to week. Yeah?
Can you access older versions of
your code? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you run into something where you've made something, you've made a commit that you really regret, you can revert it and basically roll back to place in the past. Yeah, Abel.
Will you be posting the schedule of what topics you'll cover week to week?
So yeah.
Maybe I know a lot of HTML, I'll just blow that one up.
Sure. Right. What we can do is put it, maybe even make it another column in that front page lectures. Just have week to week what I'll be covering in lab. I think that'll be an easy way for people to reference that. Cool. Awesome. So here's an intro to web development. Sort of broke out the beginning to two things. What makes it hard? You often hear people whine about, oh man, like developing for web is really hard. And I think what they're usually talking about when they're saying that is the cross-platform issues make browser-specific hacks common. It's like about getting into the nitty-gritty, like Internet Explorer does events, like you click on a button one way, Safari does it a different way, Firefox and Safari tend to do it similar ways, Opera is in its own whole other world. And like you often get in this thing where you're like, well, like, okay, now we have to, it works in Safari, it doesn't work in IE, and unfortunately IE is still enormous, so we still have to like worry about how to handle that. JavaScript as a language is really robust. If you ever take CS242, which is a great class on, I think that's the programming languages class, there's a lot of focus on JavaScript because it actually embodies a lot of really cool programming language concepts, but it's also pretty error prone. It's easy to make mistakes in it, especially because it's weakly typed. So you're like, well, I summed this integer with a string and now it's a string. I didn't mean to do that. And the other tricky thing is that there's no one language that you're using to keep it all together. You'll have JavaScript in the front end, and in the back end you'll be talking to a variety of things. You'll be talking to a Java servlet, a Python, a CGI, a PHP, CGI, any sort of things in the back end. And getting that sort of, closing that loop is a really difficult thing often. You're like, well, where's this failing? Like, is the request even getting through? And what I'll hope I'll impart to you, on you throughout the quarter is just ways of making that a little bit easier so that at every stage you're debugging what matters instead of like the whole system is sort of falling apart at any point. But on the other hand, there's a lot of things that make it fun. It's really, really quick, right? It's like you change a line in a text file and you reload and you're done. There's no like, I gotta compile, I'm gonna go play foosball for a while, come back and then I'll have an app. Oh, made a mistake, I was trying again. You'll get huge reach instantly. There's very little setup cost to people just typing in an address and it's going to your app. And again, we're lucky in that in an iPhone web app, we can make a ton of assumptions about what device people are using, what size their screen is, what their browser can do and all that. The other nice thing is like iPhone users upgrade really quickly. So there's some things that were introduced in like iPhone OS 3.0, which came out maybe in May, and like within a month, over 80% of the people that were logged on to different websites were already iPhone 3.0. So it's like, I think it's because you plug in and it's like there's an update available, and most people will just use it. So that's another nice thing. This will give four components to developing for the web, and this is what we'll be covering throughout the quarter. We'll start out with HTML, which is just the raw content, which really consists of a bunch of tags. And I'm going to go with the assumption that everybody's at least seen HTML before, and maybe you've written a little bit of a web page. CSS, which is styling. And there's a lot you can do in CSS, especially in the last couple of years with the new CSS properties that people have introduced for CSS 3, which the iPhone supports. JavaScript, which is where all the action happens. And then there's the server-side communication. So it's sort of a, I don't know if it's a stack, but it's four different components of what we'll be addressing. And again, today is number one. Again, I'll assume you have a little bit of experience with HTML and tags. So the 30-second history of HTML, hypertext is actually a really old idea. If you read back as far as Vannevar Bush is, as you may think, what he's talking about in a lot of ways is hypertext, all these hyperlinked things. This is a great article, which you'll read in 376, is that right? Yeah. I feel like I read this article like three different times at Stanford for different classes. It's one of those recurring themes. It's actually really cool if you have the chance. Anyway, the article's as you may think. I'll add a link there if you're interested in reading it. But people were imagining some sort of things like this back in 1945. The web could have been very different. I don't think anybody... Maybe somebody here is old enough to remember Gopher, but I barely do. I guess I was like five. But this is a competing standard for doing basically text on the web and links on the web. And
just looking at both of them, there's no reason why you think, oh, this one's going to succeed and this one isn't. I guess it's like Sony Betamax style. But the ultimate downfall was that the Gopher, the people behind Gopher were like, oh, we're going to start charging a licensee for that. And then everybody was like, oh, just use HTML instead. So I don't know what the lesson there is, but that was the moral of that story. HTML is huge now. And though, you know, Firefox, I found this out while doing research for this, it actually still supports Gopher. So if you're really bored, you can actually see what Gopher looks like. It's Firefox, like Gopher colon slash slash. You're going to have to find a server that still runs that. I bet there's somebody out there who does. And HTML's text, right, has to get turned into actual documents, which we'll show in a second. And the three main rendering engines that do that today, there's the IE one, which I had the name for you, and I totally lost the IE one. I always forget it. But anyway, there's the IE rendering engine. There's Gecko, which powers Mozilla, and there's WebKit, which powers Safari, Chrome, and the iPhone browser. They all have their own slight little quirks. One really fun thing about developing for the web, which I didn't have in that slide, is that people are kind of experimenting in the open on what the future of HTML actually looks like. So what the Safari developers will actually do is be like, you know what, I think we should be able to do OpenGL in the browser. We should be able to like write OpenGL code and have people try that out. So what they'll do is they'll build it and then blog about it and say, hey, in the nightly build of WebKit, there's actually OpenGL support. So there's something called WebGL, and it came out last week. And that was just, it's not a like accepted standard yet. It hasn't been finalized, but they're basically just experimenting in the open. And if you follow along closely, you'll discover all sorts of like random things that they just throw in there, like drag and drop support, which is pretty cool. All HTML documents will look like this. An enclosing HTML tag that's covering your whole body. Actually, a doc type before that. Header section, which has all your metadata, so your external JavaScript and CSS. Keywords. I haven't seen keywords in a long time. That was like the big thing for like put keywords in your header. Like Google will find you better. I think they finally like torn apart that urban legend. Actually, Google doesn't look at those at all. And most of your content will go in the body. What's going on in the background is the browser is parsing your written HTML tags, and it's doing it in a really loose way. Like the web is built for openness and sort of it's not laziness, but messiness. So it's like, oh man, I saw you. I think you were trying to close that there, so I'm going to make that assumption for you. You put two body tags in your document. I'm just going to smush them both together, and here you go. So it's kind of like the opposite of XML, which is similar looking HTML in that XML is very strict. Like, oh, you didn't close this tag. I'm done. I'm not parsing this at all. It'll build a document object model, and I'll have a graph of that in the next slide, representation of what's going on. And this is so your JavaScript can interact with it. So it's like, what is the body? Well, now it's like an element living in space. It displays the rendered onto the user. Now it's just waiting for user interaction. And since JavaScript is event-driven, it's not like your code is like running in a while loop going like, oh, did anything happen? It's more event-based. Like, all right, when the user clicks a button, then responds to it this way. When they mouse over this, when they touch, when they swipe, when they rotate their device, all sorts of stuff. And what the DOM is this was also in the early days, the middle days of HTML. Both IE and Netscape had this realization that this was kind of messy. Like, well, we need a way of interacting with HTML. So they both built their own implementations. Somehow collaborated to make a cross-browser standard, and that was DOM level 1. And what you see now on the web mostly is DOM level 2, which is just the next evolution of that. But what happens, all those tags end up as a bunch of nodes. So given this really simple HTML file, it's like my first page with a div with an ID of intro, what the browser is doing, this is a really simplified version. I'm sure it's doing some optimizations in the back end. But conceptually what's going on is it's basically just building a tree of elements. And in your JavaScript, if you want, there's faster ways of getting to things. If you wanted to get to that height there, you could actually say, like, HTML, I want your child nodes. Oh, I can see there's two. It's probably the second one. And then, no, that has only one child node, so I'm going to take the first child of that, and then the first child of that, and then we'll write the text. So, but as we'll see, we'll be using jQuery for most of the JavaScript stuff. There's faster ways of getting to almost all that content in the browser. It's actually pretty easy to do. So we covered on the left side we have the head, on the right side we have the body. What goes in the head is the script tag, for example, which has inline or external JavaScript. There's really good resources for like what all the tags are. There's some that I've never used before, like ABBRV or ABBR, which is like abbreviation. If you're like having an abbreviation in your document, the browsers actually support that. And there are good resources for that online. So this is by no means an exhaustive list. This is like the what you're most likely to hit during this class. Link and style. Link is what you'll use to get your CSS, which is your style sheets, from outside the page. Style is if you're just developing really quickly and you want to put it in the actual page itself, you can do that. Same with script. You can have it referenced external or internal. That's one slight gotcha with script. Both external and internal look the same. With style sheets, there's two different ones. the title, what the browser sees at the top, and any meta information. You'll see what the iPhone does is actually puts a lot of the device specific stuff in the meta tags, so to confirm to the standard, and we'll see what those are later. And then the actual body is all sorts of different contents. Divs, which are sort of the building blocks of your page, you can think of them as boxes. So where are all the boxes on your page? Yeah?
I don't know if you're trying to review, and I'm like just at those, but
yeah.
Can you go a little slower
okay.
Or like explain? I don't know. Very fast.
Okay, sure. Absolutely. So maybe backtrack a little bit. The way that HTML works is what you're doing is wrapping content in tags, which look like these left bracket, name of the tag, and right bracket. And what you'll have is just a set of those on your web page, and you can move them around really easy because it's just a text editor. And some of them will display content on the screen, and some of them will actually just tell the browser how to render something or tell the browser about what's going to happen when you click on things or just other meta information about the page itself. So the header of the document, so the document will they'll look like a really long version of this, where there'll be stuff in the header that's more meta, and there's stuff in the body that's more action and content, or I guess mostly just content related. And the ones that you'll encounter in the head mostly are these. And as we go through, especially when we hit like next week with CSS and JavaScript later, you'll see how these actually fit in and what goes inside all of these. Mostly here, I'm just trying to give you a sense of where they'll go eventually in the document, so the details of them aren't as important. And then in the body, what you'll have is a bunch of blocks as well. And the central one of those is the div, which is just, I actually don't know what it stands for, maybe division. I never actually thought about that. And that's sort of conceptually a block or a box. Span, which is what you'll wrap text around it. So in the early days of the web, you might actually wrap things in a B tag, which was bold. But we've moved away from that to moving more to spans, which means you like can do a lot more style things within a particular block of text. Another common task is building things out of tables. So you write, oh, yeah, I have a table of five elements. So those are the tags that you'll use there. And again, there's really good references online for what the actual list of all these are. This is sort of a starting point for where to look. So you have a table, then a bunch of TRs, which are table rows, and then TDs, which are table cells. Another common web form or pattern on the web is having forms, right? I don't think anybody likes filling these out, but they're pretty common on the web, like a registration form or a search form. And what you'll do there is wrap things in forms and have a bunch of inputs. And we'll go into more on that. When we do JavaScript, you'll see how to actually make them do smart things as you react to them and click on them throughout there. Making lists, you'll have ULs, which are unordered lists, OL, which are ordered lists, and list elements within either of those. So if you want a bunch of nice numbers, you use an OL. If you want just a bunch of bullet points or none at all, you can use a UL. And finally, what actually makes the web are A tags, our anchor tags, which are clickable links. And that's sort of what makes the web fun. And ever since JavaScript introduced what happens when you actually click on a link is pretty loose, right? I'm sure if you use Gmail, it's not like clicking a message actually takes you to a different email or takes you to a different page. It's the same page, but you know it's loading it in there. It's using AJAX, which we'll cover, which stands for asynchronous JavaScript and XHTML or XML, I think. And we'll do that. Yeah.
HTML has form functionality built into it, but a lot of times when I'm just looking at HTML code, it seems like most forms have some kind of external scripting associated with them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some sort of like relations to what's going on there. Like you see, you know, basic form syntax and then a bunch of JavaScript, you know, peppered all around it. Well, what exactly is it?
Yeah, sure. So the way forms are built, or the way HTML was built, you know, when it was built like 20 years ago, I think they just had like their 10th anniversary, but and is like a lot of years, is they always picture that you would have one page and then a form and then a submit button, and clicking on that, if you just, so the way we did this, all right, I guess this is the page and this is the content. Maybe we have form here and action, which is like to say, where should this go is, and this is on your web page, right? So this is not a good pen. And then maybe we had like one input box or whatever, which is like your name.
and then we had a submit button, which is an input type, submit.
Okay, so this is like your ultra basic form, which is like probably what you're talking about, you're seeing. So the problem with this is if people click on submit, it's just going to go to the next page. It's not going to validate whether like your username was actually 6 to 10 characters, for example, or your email just looks like an email address, or you're not trying to like actually hack the server or something crazy like that by executing stuff in the back end. Although you should probably do the check in the back end, not the front end, because it's easy to change this on the front end. Also, what you know, what's become popular, like I guess maybe the canonical example now is Twitter.com, right? When you click, you know, you have your Twitter tweet box and you hit submit or tweet. I actually don't know what the call to action there is. Instead of going to a different page, that's a form right there. But instead of like submitting it to this homepage.submit thing, what's actually going on is this: there's some JavaScript, and we'll learn how to do this, that catches that click event and says, hey, let's talk to the submit page. And when it hears back, it calls back and says, like, oh, yeah, hey, that was a good tweet. Go you. Your Twitter. Or it goes, you know, fail, like, that was over 140 characters, or that was not funny enough, or something like that. So that's basically why you'd add, why you see a lot of that HTML or JavaScript stuff getting added to forms nowadays. Cool. Does that make sense? Well, if you we'll do this, we'll poke around a couple of web pages in just a second. What you'll see a lot is people tend to structure their pages either with tables or either with divs. And there's this pretty funny website which is Give Up and Use Tables, and it basically has a little timer and it says like you spent more than like I think it's 50 minutes making a website and you're still like trying to use divs to get it to look just right, and just give up and use tables. And for the longest time, the HCI homepage was all table based, and then we rewrote it to use divs. And it's one of those like online religious arguments, like VI versus Emacs or Mac versus PC. And you know, it's the kind of thing that it's less important to understand what like the real passion is there. In practical aspects, tables are going to be much faster to get off the ground, and that's just because it's for what they're often accomplishing, they're pretty easy, right? Like if what you wanted was a two column web page, you can say, oh, these are just two table columns, and now we have two columns there, and we're done, right? Whereas with CSS, it's a little trickier. But we'll actually see how to accomplish exactly this in CSS. It's actually not that hard once you see what's going on with CSS and divs. The big reason to use divs is that they're a lot more accessible to screen readers. So if somebody who's blind is going through a web page and the screen reader is going through and trying to figure out what's important so they can navigate and what can read, if it sees a table, it's not really sure what's going on. Like, is this a table of figures? Is this actually something meaningful? Like, is it meant for navigation? Whereas with divs, you can attach a lot more divs and other elements, like kind of a header tag or something else. You can add a lot more specific information to what's going on there. They're also a lot easier to style. So we'll be building things mostly out of divs, but if you find yourself stuck this particular like tricky layout issues, don't feel too guilty about your results really using a table. It's like hardly the biggest crime you could commit in the world. So you can also check out the website. It has like argumentation for both as well. When you load up most web pages, at the very, very, very top is a doc type, which is basically saying like this is what the rest of the page is. And the two most common ones you'll see on the web are HTML4, which is what most web pages are today, or XHTML, or then there's XHTML like transitional, which is kind of like HTML. We don't have to worry about that. The idea behind XHTML was to do a stricter HTML, so you have to close every tag, you need to code every attribute, and then if you have a tag that doesn't need anything inside, like a line break there, you have to close it inside. It's just sort of two different approaches to doing the same thing. People on the XHTML side argue that it's a lot cleaner to read and easier for beginners because they're like really sure what's going on. You can really do either nowadays, and browsers will basically work. What we'll be coding in is HTML5, which kind of like handles both cases really well. If you want to be really strict and you want to close all your tags and you want to self-close all your line breaks and everything, it'll be like, fine, that's cool. And if you want, it'll also interpret that. So we can afford to be a little lazier here.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah?
I missed Mark's absence of need to be quoted. I was like, am I in a journalism class? The second time I read it, I realized what you meant. But
yeah.
Maybe somebody else missed.
Yeah, sure. So if what we did here, all these tags have attributes in them, which just modify them. Like, what kind of button did I want? I wanted a submit button. What kind of text, or what kind of input did I want? I wanted a text input. Other types are like password if you want to like
not have people reading over your shoulder, for example. And if you see here, what I did here is I took quotes around the names of the actual attributes. And if you don't do that in XHTML, it'll freak out and be like, that's not valid XML, like I'm not going to parse this page, you're done.
I just had another question.
Yeah, so it's just good practice to quote these anyway. It's just way easier to figure out what's actually going on here when you see these things in quotes. So I would strongly recommend you do that anyway. It also looks like very old school when you, I don't know why maybe it does, but when you see something like this, it just seems like something out of like 95 or something. I don't really know. But I would encourage you to quote your attributes.
I was just wondering what would actually happen if XHTML is more strict, but you didn't follow one of the rules, what would it display?
So most browsers, I think most browsers try to optimize for the user experience, and I think the worst thing is like, oh, this author just sucks, and you're not going to be able to see this web page. So most will fall back to this hybrid format, I tried, but I didn't quite get it, so I'm going to fall back into backwards compatibility mode, and it'll render the page anyway. There might be some exceptions to that, but that's generally what will happen. I think browsers, most browsers go is get content to the user no matter how weird or strange, what weird things happen on the author side of things. And what's new and up and coming, what we'll get to leverage in this class is HTML5. So there's this standards body called the W3C, and they just debate all this stuff endlessly for your benefit. And what they got to do is watch the web over 20 years, and it's clear that some things have changed and some things have evolved. So things that are coming up in HTML5 are things like drag and drop. So you can actually take a file and drag it onto your browser and drop it there, and it'll upload the file, right? Which seems kind of magic to be, because you kind of expect that to totally break, right? You're like, I don't know what's going to happen here. But it works, or it will work when more browsers implement HTML5. Doing inter-document communication, so if you have two tabs open from the same site, they can actually talk to each other and say, hey, update yourself. And local storage, which is one thing, that's the most important thing I think that we'll be covering from that later when we do JavaScript, is local storage. It actually means you can store a bunch of data on the device itself. So if you want, the first time that the user loads it, for example, it actually downloads all the muni times. And then after that, you don't have to hit the web server every time. It just loads it locally. So that'll be a useful thing for your devices. And then some also new tags that, like we saw. So Canvas, which lets you do really cool graphics, and I'll show a demo of that in a second. And then instead of having to use Flash, which is what most people on the web have used so far for video and audio, in HTML5 you can actually just write audio, video, and then link it to the file, which is really cool. And they try to add a lot more semantic elements instead of just divs, which are kind of just boxes. They're like, no, your div is actually a navigation div, so let's call it a nav. And this thing at the bottom is actually a footer, so let's call it a footer.
So just repeat, this is proposed, but it's not out in use yet?
This is a good chart. Which I can also link to, which has what the thing is. So what's going on is the date that they've set for we want everybody to be done on HTML5 is 2020, right? So that's a really, really far date out. But the today stuff, a lot of this is already implemented. Firefox already supports audio and video. Safari supports audio and video. A lot of the browsers are supporting Canvas. Google released a thing that lets you do Canvas even in Internet Explorer, so a lot of sites are using that. So it's one of those things that a lot of these are up and coming, and a lot of these are already implemented. If I cover it in an example, you can assume that the iPhone does it. That's why I would point it out specifically. I thought it'd be fun to kind of deconstruct how some websites that you might interact with on an ordinary day basis actually do their things. So I had a lot of fun with this one. Google is I think they're known for the simplistic web design, and it kind of looks like they did when they launched, but what was amazing to me is I think it was actually still written exactly like they were launched. So if you break it down, they use a font tag to spell those things at the bottom. That's just not something you see as much nowadays. You're more likely to see a span and then apply CSS styles there, as you need it to. They have a center tag, again, really uncommon in today's web. Again, you're more likely to use CSS. So what CSS did for a lot of things was take away tags that were styling tags and said, no, what you want the tags to be are just semantic. Just wrap it and tell me what it is, and then I'll style it later. But Google didn't quite get the memo.
You said this semantic presentation.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So the big idea behind that stack, the HTML, CSS, JavaScript, the idea is that your HTML should be just your content, just the meaning behind your web page and not the way it should look. And there's going to be blurry lines because no world is perfect, and we're going to see moments where this box here doesn't actually have any meaning. It's just there so that
you know, my layout looks exactly like I want it to. But we try to avoid that as much as possible. And then your CSS, the idea is like take that meaning and reformat it to any kind of thing. And the big advantage behind doing that is if you write it once, and this is like the utopian view, right? You write it once and it's just, it's laid out, it's sort of, the content is exactly as you want it. You can apply any different style sheet that says like, oh, reformat this for the iPhone, or oh, reformat this for the web, or really, really, really low-end devices, or people with visual impairments who need big fonts, right? That's the utopian vision. Sadly, just because of cross-browser incompatibilities, there are times when you're going to mix it up a little bit and put content in your JavaScript instead of your HTML, or styling in your HTML instead of your CSS, and we'll point those out in general. Yeah. So, like, and this is an example where Google chose to make that you make the trade-off where they're like, I'm sure they know that like the font tag is not the appropriate thing to surround that box with, but they probably found it was faster or more compatible, and they're like, for us, the priority isn't like semantic meaning, and at least not for this web page and all that stuff, but instead just like delivering really fast user experience to whoever's visiting Google.com. If you take Apple's website, it is like divs everywhere. So it's really funny, actually. If you, it's just these are all just nested divs inside each other, which is kind of really cool. It's actually, they have their, like, when you're here, there's NanoShoots video, and there's also like new iPhone or whatever, and that's, those are actually just also there, so they'll slide in if you want them to, which is kind of neat. We'll show you, we'll learn how to do that. If you've ever played with the Gmail for iPhone app, I think this is one of the best web apps out there. It's just really polished and just does a great job of like delivering a very compelling experience without needing to be installed at all. And seeing what they did here, most of the things are these div boxes, but things like that search box down there is a form, right, which makes sense. Like when you hit search, you probably want it to submit something. And their message list is actually a form, because if you notice, you can select, I'll go back to before the style, you can select all the different messages and then hit like archive or delete, for example, and it'll do the right thing there. So hopefully that was a helpful way of sort of seeing how different people approach this problem of like, how am I going to lay this stuff out? Like this is like the ultimate in like, we're going to make it as HTML like proper as possible. And this is sort of a, this is how we can build something for the mobile. If you like, what you'll end up is a lot of nested boxes, right? So up there is a message and there's like a box for the title, a box for the author, and a box for like the first line of the email. There's probably a box around the star and all those things, and a box around the attachment. Cool. And the last really crazy one I wanted to demo was, this is the kind of things you can do with some of the things that they've been exploring in HTML5. And the only reason this doesn't work on the iPhone is that it doesn't respond to the touch events. It responds to the keyboard. So if you've ever seen like Cool Iris, which is this like Firefox plugin and WebKit plugin too, you know that they have the really similar thing. Have you all seen Cool Iris? It's a bunch of Stanford people. The crazy thing with this is that this is actually the same thing but built using HTML, JavaScript, and CSS, which is really an indication of like how powerful this stuff is getting when like you can basically do this. And if you, one thing we'll be learning when we talk about JavaScript is how to use things like Firebug to actually inspect elements. If you look at all this stuff, that was just a div. So this is the same little building boxes as everything else with an image inside it. So it's just like, it's totally semantic meaning. It's like, oh yeah, there's a box with an image inside. But just using this and some of the things that they've been working on WebKit, you can do this like crazy like 3D wall thing, which is pretty awesome. And the iPhone actually, as of the latest version and the iPod Touch as well, hardware accelerates a lot of these things, even just in CSS. So if you wanted to do something as complex as this, you could probably do it without the iPhone choking too much. And one last deconstruction is what you can do with the audio and video tags. This is like live Twitter search results for the word HTML5. Pretty crazy. This is all just HTML and JavaScript. It makes hearts and stuff. Some Portuguese. Yeah. All right. Bye. Oh, so what was that? That was one canvas and one audio tag, right? Like, that's pretty rad. Yeah.
So a
review
is basically used to indicate that a given section of the page can treat this as somehow separate and that it should either be pulled out from somewhere else or manipulated in an interesting way, or just generally that it should not be treated as part of the uniform piece of virtual paper, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And in most cases, when you take a website and if you draw boxes around everything, you'll probably have exactly what it looks like in the HTML, with some exceptions of like just being like, oh, they meant to move some things around like that. So yeah, so that's like the up and coming, the future. Pretty awesome. There's some iPhone-specific HTML that I think you'll find yourself using throughout the quarter. And this is just how to tell your iPhone to do a few specific things. For example, if you want to tell the iPhone to render your page not as this like enormous like page of like imagine a piece of paper, if you want to basically tell it what the piece of paper size is to start out with, if you specify this in your header, so going back when we had like head and body, this would go in your header. If you write this down, and again the slides are here, so you can just copy and paste this whenever you want to implement this in your own thing. Just watch out for the quotes. I think Keynote tries to be cute and make typographers quotes, and they'll probably mess up your HTML. I'll fix that before I upload the slides. Actually, that's an annoying thing to get caught up on. And the other thing you can do is to say, like, I don't want people to be able to pinch and tap on my thing. This is the layout I want. I don't want them to be able to scale the device. So if you look at it, this is just adding one more thing to that previous one. So you're saying, like, the width of this page is actually just the device width, and I don't want it to be user scalable. And if you just dump this in your head tag, anywhere in your head tag, the iPhone will respond to that. So if you look. So what I did here, this is my iPhone portfolio in the voice of Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler's detective. So instead of being this enormous page, what we have is like the iPhone knows it's exactly this width, and that's how it's chosen to render it. If you want to see what it would have looked like otherwise, we can do that real quick too. Just a second. So over here, if we hadn't specified this device width, user scalable, no. When somebody on the iPhone loaded this page, it would have been like this tiny thing, and they're like, wait, like that's really tiny, like this is awful, like now I need to like browse this. Like it's pretty cool in the simulator. You can simulate pinching and tapping. You're like, ah, I gotta get over here and like tap it. Oh, now I did too much, now I gotta get back. So like you really wanna do that in any web page you build for the iPhone. I'll put it back so it actually works there. Cool. We should just access this. Yeah.
Is there in that tag, the meta name and whatever, there seem to be some keywords. I'm just wondering where would be the place to learn, or is there like the place where that says, all right, it's user scalable is a keyword, width is a keyword, and so on and so forth. Because in that editor right there,
yeah.
I can't tell what's a keyword and what's a value.
Oh, I see. Oh, that makes sense. So yeah, so this, I can zoom in here. Too much. There's a really good Apple documentation page about this sort of stuff, and I'll link to it too. And that just has a list of all these things. So in this case, like, this is another really good example for quoting why you quote your attributes. So his point was that like these look exactly like this looks, but it's inside a quote, and why is that different? So and that's just, since it's inside the quotes, it refers to what the content of this meta tag is. So you usually have like meta name equals blank, content equals blank. It's like, this is what it's called and this is what I want to tell you about it. So the viewport, which is the size of the screen to be rendered, and this is the stuff in the content. Does that help?
Sorry, I was looking, speaking more specifically, so width equal device hyphen width.
Yeah.
Width looks like a keyword of some kind.
Yeah.
Device width. Maybe also, mm-hmm. I mean, I was just wondering, I don't know, I guess part of my brain thought that some of that could be whatever the programmer decided, some of that was some sort of reserved keyword.
Yeah, definitely. So when I link to the Apple page, they just have a list of all these things that are valid, like things for width, for example.
Maybe the question is, can you explain how width and device width get resolved?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So when the browser hits this page, and actually that's a great question, Scott. If we just load this up in Safari, which has no width, right? It's not a device or anything. It still looks huge, right? It's not doing any resizing. So the browser tries to get anything that's relevant to it, right? So Safari is probably going through here first reading the head and seeing, oh, title, that's really useful. I'm going to stick that in the title over here. I understand some meta tags. Viewport, I don't really know what that means. I'm just going to ignore it and keep on going. Sorry, just a second. And then it'll render the rest of the page. Whereas the iPhone, when it hits that, goes, oh, viewport. I know about some viewport things. It looks like they specified a width and a user scalable thing. All right, for width, what do I know? I know device width, and there's like, you can also specify like a pixel value. So if you wanted, you can say like, the width of this page is supposed to be 150 pixels.
So the browser seems to
understand certain things, and exactly. Yeah. So like, this is if I told it that it was try to render it within a 200 page. Now it's like enormous. So then user scalable, yes or no. Like right now, you see I won't be able to zoom in and out at all here. Whereas if I had this set to yes, then I could then go, yeah, that was too big, you know. So, yeah, so basically the browser knows, and this is one of those areas where browser development, when you start getting cross-platform, is a little hard, right? You're like, well, how do I know that the browser that the user is going to see is going to understand this thing? And what you try to do is sort of degrade gracefully. Like, it'll still work. If they don't see it, it won't just look as good, for example. Yeah?
Yeah, on that same subject, do we have to do any messy stuff with user agents to figure out if it's an iPhone or
since it's a prototype, you can just assume that they're on an iPhone when they're accessing your web app. If you want to take it further or develop it further in your class, then sure, that's one way of doing that. A better way to go in general, and I can talk about this maybe like in week 10 if like people are interested in more advanced stuff, is feature detection. So be like, do you understand the video tag? Now I'm going to put a video tag here. If not, like, here's a link to YouTube or something like that. Yeah?
There's cases where pages do load randomly differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we talk about CSS, we'll talk about how to do that. But you can actually, in one web page, say, if you're on a mobile device, render this style sheet. And if you're on a screen reader, render this. If you're about to print the document, render this. And if you're just on the web, render that. So you can do that. And ideally, if you can actually get it so you can have one style sheet or multiple style sheets for one HTML page, like, you're golden, right? Because that means like you adjust one thing only when you need it to, instead of having to keep like four different versions of your page in sync at all different times. So yeah, that's you. So on the, like, in terms of like what's practically done on the web, I don't know what the breakdown is. I guess it's, a lot of the times it's just done in multiple style sheets, and in extreme cases there's like we really need to serve the specific like IE version of this thing, for example. Right, exactly. And again, like, that's really brittle to detect user agent. Yeah.
But you can't just use JavaScript on
the Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it looks like text made color codes and
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know where the slide went, but in terms of like an editing environment, I tried to find one that was like cross-platform and good, and I couldn't find one. You can use Eclipse, and Eclipse is HTML highlighting, and that'll be fine. Like, most browsers will do most text editors will do syntax highlighting for HTML. It's like a pretty easy language to parse. On the Mac, a really good free version is Text Wrangler, and it's made by the same people who make BB Edit, and it's like, it's free, it'll let you do all, it'll more than get you through this class. Yeah? Text Wrangler? I'll write it on the board. But if you eventually get, I love TextMate as an editor, but it does cost money. So Text Wrangler is a really good free alternative. Does anybody have a good Windows recommendation? I've seen some, like, yeah.
Notepad++.
Awesome. Yeah.
I like Notepad too.
Notepad, so variations on Notepad. You could actually use Notepad itself, right, if you wanted to. So Notepad++, and yeah. Yeah, that's another one I've heard good things about. So. I think those are all at least shareware or free. Those are all free. Yeah. So Crimson Editor, Edit Pad plus plus. Is that right?
Notepad plus plus,
and then Notepad 2. That's what happened after you plus plus it. So like, cool. So, yeah.
What's the standard on using single and
double quotes? That is an excellent question. I think there's two answers to that. One, I'm not actually sure what the standard says. The other thing is that, and we'll see this when we get to JavaScript. Once you have JavaScript that's actually in your HTML, it's really easy to get confused about like which quotes belong to JavaScript and which quotes belong to HTML. So what I tend to do is single quote my attributes and double quote inside HTML, and that's just something I've picked up at work, but you can really use both as long as like you're doing one thing. And I guess I'll make that concrete really quick. If we wanted it so that when you tapped that first link to say alert hi, if you start writing, alert is just a thing in JavaScript that pops in a little like, hey, little message on your screen. If I wrote alert hi here, now that you can see that text mate, and you know any good text editor will figure this out. This is bad, right? You're like, well, that quote now refers to both alert and also like it's really ambiguous what you meant there. So you have to use a single quote instead, and that'll work. And then I just personally do this instead. But again, total preference as long as you're consistent about it. And then back in Xcode, or back in the simulator, or even back in Safari, I click that, I'll say hi. So that worked. We'll do a lot more JavaScript later. I haven't done my homework, so there's no How I Me assignment yet. Cool. And that's disabling zooming. So I'll just go back into these. You can detect when the iPhone rotates, and the way you do that is set in your body tag. So this is header, and then the first thing you hit is the body, and you can add attributes to the body itself, and you can say, like, on orientation change, and again, this like in this Apple document that I'll put up, it has a list of all these, just do something. It's like some JavaScript action. So maybe you'll want to reformat your content. One of my favorite apps on the iPhone is Weightbot, and then like on the terminal view, you're seeing like you can enter your weight, and then when you rotate it, it has like graphs and stuff, which is like, from a usability perspective, not great, and that it's not very discoverable. There's like a whole other side of the application that when you rotate it, but it's kind of a neat trick. So you can consider doing different things, and we'll do maybe like a different view in the portfolio view when people rotate their device, just to make that concrete. That's the last one, and the last one is you can actually change what that little header bar with the battery looks like on your app. So if your app is a little like darker themed, you can actually make it black or black translucent, and this is how you do that. And again, like, it's less important that you figure out, you write down exactly what this is right now, but just knowing that this is an option out there and that you can look it up in the documentation. I often find, like, one difficult thing about documentation is, like, it's hard to know what's out there before you, like, know. You, like, if you don't know the possibilities, it's hard to search for. So this is just sort of a pointer about where, what that might look like. And here's the three different ways they look. So that leftmost one is the standard gray bar. The second one is, like, a black bar, and the last one is black dash translucent. And that last one is really difficult to read because your content actually renders underneath it. So I wouldn't recommend that one unless, I don't know, unless you have like a full screen game or something, then it might work. Speaking of full screen, you can actually tell the app that your app is Apple Mobile Web App capable. It's kind of a mouthful. And again, this is the kind of thing where it's like, what's the name of the value and what's the content? And the content is yes. And when you do that, what actually happens let's make our portfolio app a full page web app. So the name is, and I'm going to copy and paste it because it's so long that I don't remember, Apple Mobile Web App Capable. And then the content equals yes. And back here, if we now add this to the home screen, which is one thing, if you haven't played on an iPhone before, like the home screen is full of these application icons, but you can also add web pages to it. And most of the time, they're just shortcuts to the web page. But if you set your app to being full screen capable using that meta tag, when you add this to the home screen, it's going to get Amiibo logo for some weird reason that I can track down later. Like small plug, I guess. Now when you click it, that didn't work at all. I think I just forgot to reload before I added it. OK, let's try that one again. Now when we add it for the third time, bam, OK. Cool. So what happened here is that it actually launched its own Safari instance just for this app. And I'm almost sure you'll want to do this for your web app because it really makes it feel more like a native app. So now, like for all the user knows, they're not in Safari anymore. Like, where's the tab? They can't switch to other tabs. They can't do all this other stuff. And so that's just with one tag, you made it an app. And that's definitely something you want to do for your application. The only downside is like when you launch external links, it'll like pop open over Safari. So it's a trade-off it makes, but it probably makes sense within your app too, right? Like if you're going somewhere else, it kind of feels like you're leaving the application. That's how the iPhone generally works. Cool. And then there's just the last couple. And finally, if you want to, maybe finally, two more. If you want to give it a home screen icon, that's how you give it. It tries to guess it by just looking at the fave icon of your web page, which is something that gets set server side, which we probably won't be doing. So this is just a way of saying, like, look for it at this location, and it just has to be a PNG file, and you can make something cool looking that'll go there.
If not, it'll probably get like the Stanford logo because your stuff will be on the Stanford web space, so you'll probably want to override it unless you're making like iStanford too. And finally, I just wanted to show off how easy it is to get video and audio, which is something you might want to do in your apps if you're like doing something about that involves some rich media. If you've ever worked with Flash Video, it's like 10 lines, or it's like at least 6 lines of code to get any Flash Video on your website, and even then, like, it requires Flash. It's sort of a pain, and it's really nice how they did it in HTML5. It's like what you would expect it to. There's a video, and what's the source? Well, it's, you know, my video name. And then audio, and what's the source? It's the song name. And the way that ends up looking is, let's say, if after like this div of my bio, I wanted to say, oh look, there's a video here, and it's Philip Marlowe, and I save it. The tricky thing, you might want to turn off the web app capable while you're developing, because there's no reload button, because it's not Safari, or it doesn't have the full Safari bits, so you have to like quit it and start it over again for it to reload. That's just one thing, you should like turn it on and off. And there, like now this video is enormous, right? Like that's way too wide for the device. So maybe we actually set this to device width again so that iPhone isn't confused. And then there you go. So it's like rendered it to the actual device width, and when you click on it, it actually just like loads the movie.
Oh, that's funny. Oh yeah, guy named Marlowe. Kind of cool.
From Lady in the Lake. So this is like a quick way of getting to the built-in media player. And when you're done, it also just pops back into your app. So really seamless media stuff with very, very little effort. And this is also very good because the iPhone doesn't support Flash, so like Flash Video wouldn't have worked at all.
Does that play embedded, or do you have to go to
an external link to it? It always opens this player, like full screen and rotated. So I don't think you have control over that. I'm not sure what happens to your underlying browser. Like, I'll test this out and I'll get back to you. Like, I don't know if in the background the page is still running and or just paused, or if it actually like reloads the page when you come back. Right, exactly. Oh, and well, if you did this in the browser, you can totally do that like this. It's just like the iPhone, when it plays video, chooses to play video in that particular way. What's that? Yeah, I have to add controls to it. I think there's a, in the video tag, you might be able to say like autoplay equals yes. How's that for a guess? Hey, nice.
Oh,
okay.
So that'll
be basically what you want it to. Yeah.
Could the video just cover all the other things, or run the other 3 things?
Oh, that's a great question. So what happened is the first time I wrote this, I had it set up like this, right? And if you think about what's going on, it's trying to put these inside the video tag, and it has no idea what that means, right? It's like, what does it mean to have a list inside the video tag? So what we want to do is close the video out there, and what we can put in between is a message to people who don't have cool video-enabled browsers, like, sorry, you don't have a cool video-enabled browser. And then that'll, in older browsers, it'll show that instead of showing, like, the video, basically. So if we reload, that's a great question. Thanks for pointing that out. It kind of ate the links. There we go. So now they're back. So, yeah. Cool. I saw another couple of hands. Same question? Everybody's wondering where the links went. Cool. And this is one like addition they made, which you'll often want to have a form. This is just kind of a nice usability improvement, a form with like pre-filled values, like, hey, like, this is where your username should go, instead of having like the label on top. Especially on the iPhone where screen real estate is really difficult, this is a nice pattern. And if you end up doing this in JavaScript, there's a lot of edge cases to cover, right? You're like, well, people have to click in there and have to clear whatever the default is. But if they change anything when they click off, it shouldn't go back to the default value. But if they didn't, like, you rapidly see, like, every JavaScript program implements this at least 5 times in their life, and it's, like, less fun each time you do it. So this, they just did it for you, which is really nice. So you can just say what the placeholder is. Yeah.
Is that specific to the
proposed
HTML5?
This is proposed in HTML5 and supported in both Safari. I'm pretty sure it's supported in Safari too. Hello, class. Yeah, so it's supported in Safari too. When you click off, if you edit it, it won't change back. This thing does exactly what you want it to do without doing that. And hopefully, they'll get picked up as a standard too, because I really don't want to write another one of those. And finally, like, this is less important, but if you want to do a search box, there's some
special glue there for you as well. So if your app has searching recipes, then you can search these different recipe things. Cool. And then what we'll go into as we start doing JavaScript is the touch events. So they'll have like on touch start, on touch end, and we'll be able to do a lot of cool touchy stuff there. And yeah, we've been going through and sort of seeing this portfolio before. Hopefully this makes sense to most people, but there's the head and the body, the div boxes that surround the name and the title, and then a list of assignments for all list entries. And then we added some links there. We can actually have it click up to the name, passport, or the inspirational design assignments, for example. And this will be just, if you go through that Subversion thing and download Subversion, download it, you'll have this full document to poke around with and try to break it and see what else you can add to it just in week one. I was just adding the video, so we kind of went out of this. So hopefully we got a good sense today of what this lab will and won't teach you, sort of an overview HTML, JavaScript, CSS, and some server-side coding. Either you've checked out now or at home, you can check out this week's materials from Subversion from Google Code. And we've made a really basic iPhone-friendly HTML document with a list and a video tag that just kind of works and is scaled properly to the device. Cool. Any last questions? Next week we'll take the CSS to take. That page looks really awful right now. So we'll take it from there to something really styled and that looks really nice. Cool. Any last questions? All right. See you all next week. Yeah. Oh, Flashlight is a really good
one. This is a great classroom, huh?
Yeah, this is great.
This is awesome. I apologize. For reasons unbeknownst to me, the registrar decided only 30 people are allowed to sign up. But actually, so.